coming up on Golf Today, what will Phil do next? The question has never carried more weight than it does right now. Will he defend at the PGA? What about LIV Golf? We'll speak to Phil's unauthorized biographer, Alan Shipnuck, coming up. And the director of golf at Southern Hills, Kerry Cosby, stops by to talk about playing 18 with Tiger Woods. How did the 15-time major champ look both physically and his game? And can Tiger win again? And they say the stars at night are big and bright deep in the heart of Texas. The field at the AT&T Byron Nelson is loaded with big-time players ready to make big-time moves. Don't mess with Texas. It's Golf Today.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
Hope your Tuesday is off to a fantastic start. This is Golf Today. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch of Golf Week magazine. On Monday, the full field was released for next week's PGA Championship at Southern Hills Country Club in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The list included four-time PGA champion Tiger Woods, who won at this venue back in 2007, as well as the defending champion Phil Mickelson. In fact, Phil has not teed it up since his controversial comments regarding Saudi Arabia and LIV Golf. It's been a long while. So, Eamon, I want to tell me something. Is this something or nothing? We've got Tiger and Phil at this point, a week away, still on the field list.
In theory, it's something and nothing, really, until 9 days from now when play gets underway. But we're going to know probably by Monday or Tuesday at the latest whether or not they're going to play. At some point, somebody will announce they're in or they're out. And at this point, it's really not clear. But it builds anticipation. And if you're the PGA of America, you've got to love the anticipation that's being built around your championship here. At a certain point, though, you don't want the anticipation to become a circus when it moves into championship days next week, which could only really happen, I suspect, if it's Phil, because with Tiger, it's an issue of the physical strength to play the golf tournament. Phil's situation is more political, more personal.
Yeah.
It's a circus that exists outside of the ropes, whereas the Tiger circus would be pretty much contained with inside the ropes.
And we're used to seeing the Tiger circus. I think Tiger is in. He's told us he's playing the Ben Hogan schedule, finished 47th at the Masters. No real setbacks. I imagine he will be on that first tee next week. Amazing. In Tulsa. This is where he won in 2007. We're going to have Kerry Cosby, the director of golf from Southern Hills, on in just a little bit. As for Phil, I tell you what. Does he want to be the middle of the circus, the center of the storm in this way, dealing with the media? Is it still too hot, too combustible at this point for him to show up and defend his title? All we've seen so far are grainy Instagram, you know, videos with him and his beard and swinging, you know, hard and looking decent. But at this point, I don't think Phil's going to be there.
Well, in his statement stepping back from the game back in February, Phil said that he was happy to be out there in public and take the shots from people, as he described it, in an effort to try to get the PGA Tour to function more in the way Phil Mickelson thinks it ought to function. So he won't get a bigger platform to continue that same fight than next week if he were to show up and do that. But he would do that knowing that it would alienate the championship he's defending, to suddenly use it as a platform for another agenda. So he may choose not to show up next week. And if he doesn't, well, then that has its own layer of nuance to it as well, because suddenly he stands accused of building more anticipation around the first Saudi event in London, which he has asked for a release from the PGA Tour to compete in. The verdict on that release is due by end of business today.
Lots of questions, big-time questions still to be answered. So here's a reminder of the outright odds for that PGA Championship, powered by our friends at PointsBet Sportsbook. You see, Jon Rahm, he's lived atop this list, named the tournament, he's been there. Scottie Scheffler, also at plus 1,200. Rory McIlroy, after a terrific week, fifth place finish outside the nation's capital, plus 1,400. There you see at the bottom, Tiger and Phil, plus 4,000 and plus 12,500. Respectively. So speaking of the co-favorite, the Masters champ, Scottie Scheffler, actually visited Southern Hills last Thursday alongside his Zurich Classic partner and fellow Texan Ryan Palmer, the assistant pro there, Cameron Chim, caddied for the world number one and came away with a rave report. Now, we know Scottie's called this his favorite golf course. He played one ball the entire time, no practice putts, and made it look easy. He's number one in the world, and it was pretty easy to see why. It would be hard to say he's not going to win or at least be in contention. He hits it far enough. and he has just incredible distance control with his irons. Ryan shot 2 or 3 under and looked like he was standing still based on how Scotty was playing. His proximity on most holes was 6 to 8 feet. The greens weren't slow, but they were wet. His speed control was good and just took the break out a lot of them. He looked like he was converting them easily. So Scotty Scheffler not the only one making some spins around Southern Hills. Justin Thomas, a couple other big names, playing alongside Jordan Spieth on Monday. Course is awesome. Some nice PGA Championship prep before next week, as JT posting this to social media. It's going to be a fantastic week in Dallas. A lot of big-time players. You see Sam Burns, a couple wins already this season. Brooks Koepka, Joaquin Niemann. There you see Scotty Scheffler. So fascinating. Tiger always typically would take the week off before a major championship. These Tiger babies, they're playing back-to-back weeks trying to get ready for that second major championship of 2022. And for more on all the happenings outside Dallas, we welcome in our own Amy Rogers.
Thanks, Damon. Well, players have long grappled with the decision whether to play the week prior to a major championship or not. It's a personal preference that really seems to vary from player to player and sometimes even major to major, depending on how they're playing. But this week, several of the world's top-ranked players are here in the field at the AT&T Byron Nelson, which is just 1 week ahead of the season's second major championship, the PGA Championship. 54 players who are in the field this week will make the trip here from Dallas to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Southern Hills Country Club for the season's major. Now, the players that are competing this week are faced with a unique challenge. And first and foremost, they want to play well here, try and get a win, while also balancing that urge to try and make those final preparations ahead of the major championship.
I think it's all just a continuous process, so just keep doing what I've been doing. I don't think it really changes much for the majors. Obviously, you want to play better in the majors than the regular tournaments, but you can't really control that much. You just always try to play your best.
I think it's just getting your body ready, mentally prepared for a major championship. I think you can kind of dial in a few things that you've been working on. Taking a week off, you might kind of not have the same feel coming back. So I've always played my best golf playing quite a few weeks in a row, 2 or 3 weeks in a row, week off, and then playing a major. But I had the last couple weeks off, and I didn't want to come into a major after having a month off. So playing here and looking forward to this week as well as the PGA Championship.
For me, this week is huge too. It's obviously, a major next week is massive, but this week it's going to be a big purse. It's a strong field. It's a great tournament. Like, I really enjoyed playing here last year. So for me, my focus is going to be on here right now. And then, Sunday evening, I'll see what I learn and see what I need to improve on for next week. But for me, my focus for me is going to be this week.
Is it challenging to maintain that sort of balance and not getting too ahead of yourself, knowing a major is kind of lurking around the corner?
It is to a certain extent, but, golf is a funny, funny game. It's one of the things, if you can gain a bit of confidence in what you're doing right now, it can be kind of a lasting feeling. So that's going to be my thing, going to have a good week, build some confidence, and then kind of use that going into next week.
I want to win. I think we all want to win when we tee it up. Some guys obviously prepare harder for majors and take it more seriously, but, I'm out here every week doing what I need to do to try and win. So I'll do that this week. If push comes to shove, I might take a little extra rest knowing what's coming next week. But other than that, yeah, here to win.
Adam Hadwin has largely not played the weeks prior to a major championship. He's really changing things up here this week. It'll be just the third time that he plays the week prior to a major, hoping to kind of reverse the trends of the past. His best finish, just one top 25 in the majors. Well, also in the field here this week, the winner of the season's first major championship and world number one, Scotty Scheffler. Also here, former PGA champions Justin Thomas and Brooks Koepka. Damon?
All right, Amy, on the ground for us at the Byron Nelson. I love this question about players deciding to play or not play. Tiger would take the week off typically. Phil 1 year won in Atlanta by 13 shots and then went on to win the Masters in 2006. Pete Sampras of tennis fame used to call it being match tough. How many reps do you want ahead of time? And then there's also just the philosophical standpoint of the Byron Nelson itself, having this strength of field, having, thank goodness, Justin Thomas, and having a couple Texans like Jordan Spieth and Scottie Scheffler bringing the crowd out. When Byron Nelson passed away in 2006, this field took a large hit. Nice to see the likes of Koepka and DJ and players at a very important tournament, in my opinion.
It really just proves, Damon, how important geography is in this game. And in terms of the decision-making before a major, a lot of that, I think, comes down to the combination of game and geography. Do you need to be match sharp? Are you searching for form? Are you trying to bed in swing changes? That applies to a lot of guys who are in the field or just trying to test their health a little bit. In Koepka's case, to make sure he's game sharp. We haven't seen him since Augusta either. But the geography is important. It's a pretty short hop from Dallas to Tulsa for next week's PGA Championship. And we see this play out all the time. You look at the Travelers Championship here in Connecticut, which typically draws one of the strongest fields all season long on the PGA Tour. But the field was slightly diminished in 2019 and 2021 when the US Open was played the week before on the West Coast at Pebble Beach and Torrey Pines, respectively. This year, it's got one of the strongest fields you're going to see all year long on the PGA Tour schedule because the US Open has been played in Boston the week before.
It's a great point. Also, you think about how robust the PGA Tour schedule is and the best players in the world kind of being able to pick and choose and set the schedule as they would like because of, you know, increased purses and invitationals and World Golf Championship events. Not an Olympic year, but an Olympic year is kind of weighing that into their summer plans as well. How much do you think that for the best players in the world, like a DJ, like a Koepka, that they can kind of take the wide view and say, I'm playing here, I'm not playing here, I want to peak here, as opposed to someone 100th on the FedEx Cup standings?
Well, generally speaking, the farther you are down that list, the less options you have. You kind of want to take every start you can get and try to make more headway. A lot of guys will make decisions based on commercial responsibilities they have.
Right.
If they have a relationship with a sponsor of the tournament, they're going to feel obliged to play that tournament. And particularly this week, Jordan Spieth is an AT&T guy and has been for his entire career. And to me, it also depends a lot on what they expect the challenge to be before a big event. You look at the guys who played Bay Hill the week before the Players Championship, and they had the heck beaten out of them by the time they even got to TPC Sawgrass. And there were some mutterings afterwards that if that continues to be the style of golf offered at the Arnold Palmer Invitational, it might dissuade some guys from playing that as their immediate stop before they go to the Players Championship.
I kind of thought it was a little bit of belly aching because one week it's like, oh, the courses are too easy. I don't want this to become a putting contest. And the next week it's, oh, my gosh, a U.S. Open broke out in Orlando, the city beautiful. I mean, I thought it was a little bit of belly aching personally.
Well, you know me. I love to see these guys get savaged week in and week out.
Once in a while.
Yeah, I like to see them have to, you know, grind out some pars once in a while. U.S. Open's one of my favorite tournaments to watch for that reason. But you can understand why if they're trying to play their way into the career-defining championships, that they may not want that kind of battering before they get there. I mean, you look at last week. To me, actually, last week was tremendously entertaining golf. Despite the weather and the difficulty of the golf course, it was a total grind, but it was fun to watch. Guys would be less enamoured of that kind of challenge if it was coming this week, knowing where they have to go next week.
Yeah, the rough was thick at Bay Hill. The greens were slippery. And then we saw just Amy Rogers standing there. Looked pretty windy at TPC Craig Ranch. Can you imagine the players that are playing this week? Should it be a very windy, difficult test? And we often hear about players, especially when they play in windy conditions, perhaps in the UK, for example, and then trying to take their game to the next week, and sometimes things are a little bit off. It could be a start in Hawaii, you know, at the Century, and then at the Sony, and trying to get back to the mainland, and their swing's a little bit off because they played so much in the wind.
If they're going to be upset by playing in the wind in Texas, they should pack up and head home instead of going to
Tulsa. It's going to be windy in Tulsa
next week. They need it to blow hard this week, because the harder it blows this week, then the better it's going to feel next week.
Yeah, a lot of great storylines for the big-time players in Texas. Also, some fantastic storylines for the Monday qualifiers. How about Wesley Bryan? I was texting with Wesley this morning. A buddy of his thought I was on a flight to Dallas. I'm not. I'm here in Stamford, Connecticut. But congrats to the 2017 winner of the RBC Heritage on making it through. There's Andrew Loop on this list as well. LSU Tiger. Fantastic basketball player, by the way. Don't try to play one-on-one hoops with Andrew Loop.
Well, the LPGA Tour's Cognizant Founders Cup has been played at a new venue for the third straight time. But one thing hasn't changed. The winner, world number one, Jin Young Ko, is going for her third straight victory in this event. We'll have more on that when we come back.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet. This season, don't just bet, live your bet life. And WinGrips, the best grips in golf. And Bushnell Golf and the Pro XC, experience the best. Ambon, introducing the Cobra King Forge Tech Irons, a better player's iron. Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
This week, the LPGA Tour honors its own history at the Cognizant Founders Cup. The tournament honors the Tour's 13 original founders while showcasing some of the modern game's best talent. This year, the event will be played at a new venue, Upper Montclair Country Club, Clifton, New Jersey. We've seen a familiar name win this event the last two times it was played. Flashback here to 2019, Jin Young Ko won the event shooting 22 under par for the week in Arizona, finishing one stroke clear of Jessica Korda, Nelly Korda, Carlotta Seganda, and Yu Li. Well, there was no event in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic, so in 2021, Jin Young Ko finished off a wire-to-wire victory in the Founders Cup with her 14th consecutive round in the 60s, and that matched a 16-year record held by Annika Sorenstam. She'll look for the three-peat this week in New Jersey. And here are the recent results of Jin Young Ko in 2022. Coming off that win to start the year at the HSBC Women's World Championship, most recently finishing second in the Palos Verdes Championship, and in between a shocking tie for 53rd in the season's first major at the Chevron Championship. And Damon, we now have a situation where we can see there are four straight tournaments Jin Young Ko has not won.
Yeah.
This counts as a slump with Jin Young Ko because she hasn't actually gone four tournaments without a victory since last summer.
Yeah, this is like the Tiger Woods, you know, Tiger's in a slump. I think we learn about the best players in the world in their struggles, and for her, this has been a struggle, but she also struggled a little bit emotionally at the beginning of 2021. She lost her grandmother, and she felt guilty that she was traveling the world as a professional golfer and decided to dedicate the rest of 2021 to her late grandmother, and she won five times. And she talked about how proud she hoped her grandmother was looking down from heaven. This year, the strife was on the golf course when in Los Angeles, and we watched it at Wilshire, when she had that unforeseen quadruple bogey, her first ever quadruple bogey eight in her LPGA career.
Every quadruple is unforeseen.
For her, except right? Ours, except for us. But then she bounces back the next week, final round 66, and loses to Marina Alex by one shot. I love seeing how the best players in the world, they can bounce back from strife and struggle, and it's not really long-lived. I'm not worried about this player. If there was one aspect that I do worry about is she missing Nelly Korda? Because there was such a buildup to this rivalry, and is it a Borg-McEnroe situation where McEnroe was a little bit kind of lost in the wilderness, you know, wanting Bjorn Borg to come back? Because it seemed like we were at the cusp of this great rivalry.
That's really been in the back of my head as well over the last couple of months with Nelly Korda's absence. Is we did have the makings of a wonderful rivalry. And the golf game has not had one since the last one was also on the LPGA Tour. You go back to Annika Sorenstam, Carrie Webb, more than 20 years ago to get a rivalry. And it really was shaping up, particularly over the last few events of last year where they seemed to be trading wins in the second half of 2021. With Nelly out of the game, you wonder if she does actually have that little lacking of fire, the need to prove something to someone. But it's not as though she's beating anyone else right now. I mean, she's not exactly playing badly. She finished second last week. I'm just wondering, is she judged by impossibly high standards now at this point?
I think she is. I think she has incredibly high standards and has talked about the fact that, hey, you know, last year, you know, what did Nelly do? Nelly won an Olympic gold medal. She became number one in the world and also won a major championship. So she was saying between the two of them, she thought maybe Nelly deserved Player of the Year honor. So I think, you know, at the age of 26, with 13 LPGA wins, two of them major championships, she feels that she has some bigger, you know, boxes that she wants to check in 2022. I'll be fascinated to see how the rest of her major championship season goes. She did not play very well in the California desert in the first major championship of the year, four more majors on the LPGA. The standards are nearly impossible, but I feel like she also holds herself to those standards.
Yeah, and it's been 3 years since she triumphed in a major championship. So heading to Pine Needles in a few weeks, I think she's going to feel a little bit of heat, as a lot of them will, to prove themselves. But you to win as consistently as she does and as dominantly as she does, certainly through a lot of 2021, and then to just not quite be there in the major championships. I was shocked by the T53 at the Chevron.
She's played
well there before. She's been a champion there before. And suddenly the game just seemed entirely off the boil for her.
Yeah, she puts a lot of pressure on herself, but her expectations are among the biggest and the greatest in this game. And speaking of which, still to come, two big-time guests you're not going to want to miss on this Tuesday. How about the head pro at Southern Hills? Kerry Cosby joins with more on next week's PGA. You know, he played that practice round with Tiger Woods. What insight does Kerry have? And, yes, Alan Shipnuck joins with more on the book that is making headlines. We're talking all things Phil when Golf Today returns. And season three of the Connor Moore Show premieres tonight exclusively on Golf Pass. Right now we're joined by the man himself, Connor Moore. First off, congrats, buddy. The Connor Moore Show has over 20 million views on Golf Pass and social media since it began. You're starting this third season. What can we expect from the Connor Moore Show this year?
Firstly, thanks a million. Thanks for having me, guys. This year, I think the COVID restrictions have lifted and so have the shackles off us. There's a lot of ranting. We all in golf, we love a good rant. We've got some great interviews. We have some really, really good sketches that we've done. And if these sketches, you know, come out half as good as, you know, they felt like they were coming when we were filming them because we had such a laugh, it's going to be great. It's amazing. When you say to me there are 20 million views, I'm like, wow. Because I remember 2 years ago when we started this and it was just right. I moved to Florida just before COVID. COVID hit then. I didn't even think it was going to happen. I kind of even wanted to go home. It was such a weird time. And in fairness, but for the foresight of like Justin Tupper and especially Franz Salameda, they pushed us to get this off the ground. And thank God they did. Like, it's been a great, great 3 years.
Well, Connor, where did the ideas come from? Because the show is named after one guy, but presumably it's more than one guy who's behind the ideas for the show.
It is. Like, we have a whole writing staff, something that I wasn't accustomed to here in Ireland. A lot of us had different stories. We'd be playing golf together and we'd just say something and something would happen. It's even like the bag clean out there. And this happened to like me and another guy, Jason. It was amazing. It's like, I remember we were downstairs. I was downstairs and my wife went over to my bag and she was like, I can smell vinegar or something from your bag or whatever. And I was like, no, you can't. And she goes over to my bag. She finds three bananas that have been there for like a year in my bag. And it was like my favorite sketch though that I did definitely was with Jay Larson, where it was like the first time I ever played golf in America. And it wasn't the first time I played golf. It was nearly my first American experience, where I didn't know what a breakfast ball was or whatever. So I hit my tee shot off the first and he hands me a ball. He says, here, have a breakfast ball. I was like, all right. Then he gives me a couple of mulligans. And all of a sudden, I end up, I hadn't even broken 90 at that stage. And I ended up, I think I shot like 79 that day with all the gimmies he gave me and stuff. So that was that was my first experience of golf in America.
Well, there are very generous people over here. That's why I live here too as well. Are there any special guests we can look forward to this season?
We got plenty. We got Kenny G. He's on tonight. We interviewed him. That interview was, I think we had to cut it down to like 10 minutes, but we spoke for maybe 2 or 3 days on the Zoom. He is a golf fanatic. That was great. We also had Jim Jeffries came on. He did a sketch at Matt Walsh. We've got Manolo on tonight, the golf instructor extraordinaire. So, yeah, it's been incredible. I think this is definitely our best season, and I can't wait for it to start off tonight.
Before we go, can we hear from Ian Poulter? Ian, how's the year going for you so far?
I think it's been a decent year. You know, we've started off quite enough, really, haven't we? The Masters, didn't get to play. That was nearly a disaster. I mean, imagine the Masters without the big three, me, Tiger, and Phil. But Tiger, in fairness, he played. Although I told him, I said, I think you should retire. But, you know, he's a competitor and he wants to break the record, doesn't he? I said to him, I said, you're 46, mate. I mean, you can't compete anymore when you're 46. But he said he wants to break the record. But, I mean, he's got to win another 4 Ryder Cups to catch me, doesn't he? And I don't think he can do that, you know? And even if he wins another 4, I'll probably win another 5. I mean, I'm still young. I'm only 46, you know?
Now, we heard your Gary Player recently met the actual Gary Player, Connor, right?
I did. I was at the Insperity Invitational and I got up and I was doing my Gary Player. Jim Nance was asking questions and there I was. Yeah, as you can see, I was doing a couple of press-ups and all of a sudden I said, like, no, Gary Player impression is complete without a couple of push-ups. And as I was doing my push-ups to the crowd, Gary Player comes up, rips off his shirt, throws it off, onto the ground, and he beats me in a press-up competition. So that was it.
And Gary Player can still get it done. And Connor, so can you. Congratulations on season 3 of the Connor Moore Show. We'll speak to you soon, pal.
Guys, thanks a million. I'm sorry, I just want to name out Shane Lowry keeps calling my phone. He's seen me on the television. I kept trying to cancel it. So if you saw me doing this a couple of times, it was because of him. So
tell him he should be practicing for next week, Connor.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he should be. He should be concentrating a bit more on his golf. But he's at home watching this, and there, I can see these messages coming in on my phone, and I'm like trying to not get thrown. But
looking forward to it. Season 3, Connor Moore on Golf Pass. Welcome back to Golf Today. Next week, Major Championship Golf returns to Southern Hills Country Club as the renowned course in Tulsa, Oklahoma, plays host to the PGA Championship for the 5th time. It looks mint. Last time the course hosted the PGA Championship, 2007, Tiger Woods beat Woody Austin by 2 with his 4th Wanamaker Trophy. Had that 62.5 on Friday, you might recall. Look for his former caddy, Steve Williams. 13th major championship in all. Now, Tiger was on property in late April to play an 18-hole practice round. Did not have caddy Joe LaCava on the bag. Instead, went out with the director of golf, Kerry Cosby. And Kerry joins us now on this Tuesday. Good to see you, buddy. You know, it created quite a buzz when the golf world found out that Tiger was on the course a couple of weeks ago with you. How did this practice round come together? Tiger text you? Did one of his buddies tell you? How did it even happen?
Well, we got a call from the PGA just saying that Tiger and his team would like to come down and get a look at the golf course and the changes that Gil Hanse and Jim Wagner and their crew made a few years back. And they connected us with his group and needed a couple of caddies because I offered it up. I didn't realize the wake that was going to be behind all of that. I should have, I guess. But, yeah, it caused quite a buzz from the moment while he was in the air. And then, of course, when he touched down and all the way through the round and he left here looking like Elvis heading off the stage.
What was it like being out there with him, Kerry? And what kind of sense did you get from the information he wanted to get out of the day?
Well, you know, as just a fan and a golfer, it was pretty surreal just to watch it, you know, from that viewpoint right there for 18 holes. Somebody that, you know, we all admire for his accomplishments, but probably more so for his grit and will to compete and the heart that he's shown over the course of his career, you know, specifically the last few years. So that part from just my standpoint was really just amazing to watch. Very inquisitive about the changes. He remembered all of the golf course, every club he hit, it seemed like, from 07, and just was asking different what had changed on certain holes, and you could tell his recollection from 15 years ago was perfect. He seemed to enjoy the changes, thinks it's a little bit more of a got to be a little more precise maybe coming into the greens. Probably a little bit, he didn't say this, but in my case, just my opinion, it's a little bit maybe easier driving golf course than it was back then, but have to be a little more precise with the approach shots as you come in. The edges of the greens, much more crowned. Got the Maxwell rolls back that were established with the restoration work, and it's closely mown almost in every area around the green. So balls that sometimes miss by a pace or two, just kind of just off the green, can now be 10 yards, 20 yards, even 50 yards away from the hole. Around a lot of these greens.
Kerry, you've been around a lot of great players in your time. After spending that time with Tiger, what makes him different in terms of how he sees the game?
Well, you know, I probably concentrated better watching him play than I have in a round of my own for the past 10 years. I really just zoned in on every mechanic, how he's setting up. You know, I really wanted to watch and appreciate what he does. His ability, I think the thing that he does, and you guys know this better than I do, just his ability to focus and kind of block out everything around him, probably out of necessity based on what follows him around, is really remarkable. Even on a casual practice round day, you know, our clubhouse was still open. The golf course had been closed. So there was a number of members that had come out for lunch. Probably a few of them came out for lunch impromptu after they saw the social media posts of his landing in Tulsa. But I think his ability just to block it all out and hit shots is remarkable.
Kerry, obviously Tiger wanted to do some reconnaissance on the trip ahead of the PGA Championship, but there was also the assumption that he was physically testing himself in terms of his ability to compete over 4 days. Did you get any sense of how he was physically, how the walk taxed him during the course of that round?
You know, he didn't. I think the walk is a little bit easier here than it is at Augusta National. And, you know, so he went through 4 days. We all watched, you know, on every move that he made at Augusta. He obviously seemed like he was tired or maybe laboring a little bit more as he went on through that over the weekend. He didn't say anything about it, didn't mention anything, but he certainly looks like it hurts just to walk. So it's remarkable that he's out here even trying, and it doesn't look like it hurts when he hits shot though. That was something that was pretty evident. Hits shots, it's great to watch. Everything he did was really, really good and spot on. But then, his walks, it certainly looks like he's in pain. But again, he didn't mention that or he didn't say anything. It certainly didn't say it to me.
Kerry, after seeing him up close, why can he win or why can't he win?
Well, from the golf shot standpoint, he can certainly hit all the shots required. I'm sure he's not the longest any longer, but compared to some of the younger guys, he's, even at 46, he hits it out there pretty good. Really good ways, and he just hits it solid every single time. You know, the guy in charge of cleaning his clubs, that's about the only thing good I did the entire day was probably keep his clubs clean. And it didn't have to do much. It's just right in the middle. It looked like about a dime size on every shot he hit, including bunker shots and pitch shots. So it was he can certainly hit the shots. I think probably the physical side of it, can he go 4 days with a few days of practice prior to that? And compete, because as you guys know, it's taxing just as a health to a healthy person to play 4 days of competitive golf and then a few days of practice leading up to that. So that would probably be I'm on his camp. I was well before I caddied for him. I think he could do anything, and I thought he'd win again when he won again at 19 with the Masters and the Tour Championship the previous fall. So I wouldn't put him out of anything. If there's one person we shouldn't count out, it's Tiger Woods.
Well, some of the guys he's going to have to work his way past, Kerry, have also been in town in Tulsa over the last few days. Scottie Scheffler was there with his buddy Ryan Palmer, Justin Thomas, Jordan Spieth. Have those guys been knocking on your door as well, looking for some insight to the golf course?
Excuse me. I did walk. We've had a number of players. Will Zalatoris came in the winter when we were, pretty much khaki wall to wall. And played in January. Patrick Reed came in for a good, he worked his tail off for 2 days, especially worked hard on the greens and kind of getting his sight lines down. And then, as mentioned, Scottie Scheffler and Ryan Palmer were here last week, Spieth and Thomas yesterday. John Rahm was out yesterday and is out there right now as we speak playing. I went around the back nine with John, spent a lot of time with Patrick as well. When he was here, and Spieth and JT had looked like they had an entourage. So Bones was with him. He knew his way around the golf course, and one of our best caddies was with him as well. So that's pretty much. I'm not going to offer. I don't know what I can offer these guys other than maybe an angle or two here and there, or a hole location that you got to be careful with, because they see the golf course pretty easy for them.
Kerry, we're blessed in this generation with fantastic 20-somethings on the PGA Tour, and yet Tiger shows up on a Monday at Augusta National, and it's like Woodstock. You called him Elvis. Are you surprised that at 46, with everything he's gone through, that all of a sudden more people are ordering club sandwiches on the veranda and Arnold Palmer's at Southern Hills, and it's just like time hasn't stood still?
Yeah, he's we've known this. He's got an aura about him, and he's just a transcendent, athlete and popular culture icon. It's really fun to watch. And it was neat to be inside that circle for a few hours just as a golfer and a fan, just to watch how he does it. One of the things that just talking with some of the friends around here is that, he hits it through any window and it doesn't look like he changes anything in his setup. I was just amazed by that. So I've been, if I had time to practice, that's what I'm going to practice on. How do I do that? But he certainly, and you hear the top players in the world, all the guys you just mentioned, that when he's on property, it's a different atmosphere. And he brings, it's just the energy is just different, and it's pretty cool to watch.
Kerry, Tiger won at 8-under par. Alex Chayka won the senior PGA at 8-under par. Ray Floyd won at 8-under par 40 years ago in a PGA there. And Retief Goosen won at 4-under, which is the USGA's version of 8-under par in a US Open. What's your target number next week?
You know, just looking at the forecast, we had a lot of rain the past couple of weeks or a few days ago, and we're drying out now, and it's warm and windy, and we're hoping that it stays warm and windy throughout the tournament. If it does, and it's not, last couple of days have been really windy, so I think that would affect it. But assuming that it's a a normal 10 to 15 mile an hour south wind and 85 degrees, and it doesn't, we're hoping for no rain. I'm going to say, 6 to 10 under par. Kerry Haig obviously is tremendous at setting up a golf course and knows he's going to be able to get the best out of the best players. We've had 7 professional majors in the past, and 31 people have ever finished under par. So, and it's 450 yards longer than last time we had an event. So it certainly is a challenge, and when the wind gets up, it can really test you.
Well, Kerry, I know next week will be a real quiet, sleepy, easy week for you. your phone won't be ringing at all. Thanks so much for your time and reliving some of those moments with Tiger a couple weeks ago.
Good to be with you guys. Look forward to having you here next week.
Well, from talking Tiger to talking Phil, next up we'll be joined by the author of a highly anticipated and very unauthorized biography of Phil Mickelson. The book comes out next week. The author, Alan Shipnuck, is coming up next. Phil Mickelson hasn't hit a shot on the PGA Tour in 4 months, but that hasn't stopped him being the subject of a lot of stories and even more speculation. Some of that centres on a new unauthorised biography of Mickelson dropping next week. The author of that book, Alan Shipnuck, is with us. And things have been coming in twos for Parker Coody since his birth. His twin brother plays alongside him at the University of Texas, but yesterday in US Open qualifying, he doubled up on something else, and the odds of it happening were 67 million to one. Find out what as Golf Today continues.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
Another hour of Golf Today on a Tuesday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch of Golf Week Magazine. One of the big topics of conversation in the world of golf over the last few months has been Alan Shipnuck's soon-to-be-released book, Phil, the Rip-Roaring and Unauthorized Biography of Golf's Most Colorful Superstar. February 17th, Shipnuck released details of a conversation he and Phil had back in November, in which Mickelson told Shipnuck he had helped the Super Golf League draft its operating agreement, saying further about the Saudis, quote, "They're scary bleeps to get involved with. We know they killed Washington Post reporter Jamal Khashoggi and have a horrible record on human rights. They execute people over there for being gay. Knowing all of this, why would I even consider it? Because this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to reshape how the PGA Tour operates." Soon after that excerpt was posted, Phil released a statement of his own, which concluded by saying, quote, "I know I have not been my best and desperately need some time away to prioritize the ones I love most and work on being the man I want to be." And Alan Shipnuck, the author, joins us now. It's great to spend some time with you, Alan. You've covered Phil Mickelson and the cult of lefty since 1994. Why was now the right time for this book?
You know, it's incredible that no one had ever captured this big, juicy, controversial life in a book. My shelves sag under the Tiger Woods biographies, and yet Phil, in a lot of ways, is a more fun, more colorful character. And so it just felt as he was kind of heading into the back nine of his career that it was time to really round up all the fun stories and all the thrilling victories and all the slapstick defeats. And I expected as I dived into this reporting that there would be a few juicy bits. I didn't know exactly where this book was going to take me. But I've been tracking Phil's whole career. I mean, my first season on tour was his second full season. So I've always been drawn to him. He's incredibly charismatic. He's fun to be around. He's obviously fun to watch and write about. And so I just felt like after a lifetime of reporting on Phil and writing SI cover stories and being in his orbit, it was time to really go deep and understand him in a different way.
There's a lot of interesting vignettes in this book, Alan. In particular, you detail some pretty extreme gambling losses, an opulent lifestyle, generosity to other people. I mean, there was always a lot of money coming in with Phil, but it seems as though there was always a lot going out as well. Were you surprised to find out just how large Phil Mickelson lives?
Yes and no. I mean, little bits had leaked out through the years, you know, Amy buying him an actual T-Rex skull as a birthday present. You know, they don't sell those down at the mall. And we know about the jets and the mansions and all that stuff. So he clearly enjoyed, you know, conspicuous consumption. But and everyone's always known that Phil likes to gamble. That's not a secret. And, you know, anecdotally, there was some big losses. There was probably a few big wins along the way. But no one had ever really understood the scale of it. And just through my reporting, I was able to get some actual numbers, which I think shed some light on the fact that this is more than just a casual hobby. I mean, this is a big part of his life. And, you know, one of the primary questions in this whole Saudi seduction is why is Phil doing this? Does he really need the money that bad? You know, we've all seen where he is on the PGA Tour career earnings list, and we know about all the endorsements, and it was just assumed he was sitting on this empire. But when you look at the scale of the gambling, you have to wonder if that's helped, you know, compel him to go down this road. Does he actually need the money more than we think? So I thought, you know, to bring some actual reporting to that and find a hard number, well, it was enlightening.
Alan, on the gambling, you have anecdotes with Gary McCord during PGA Tour events with the hand signals from the 16th tower on whether Phil can two-putt from 50 feet to the lavish trips to Vegas with the sports gambler Billy Walters. You write, quote, Phil has always tried to get his fix through gambling, end quote. How deep did it actually get?
Well, clearly very deep. I mean, when you're talking about millions of dollars changing hands because of losses in sports betting, I mean, that is substantial. And even if you're making $40 million, like, you know, Phil was, after you pay your taxes and all your expenses and your jet and all the people you're in your employ and everything else that goes into this very large life, you know, how much is really left? And if you're losing $10 million a year, there's not that much left over. So, you know, I think it's clear that, you know, Phil was really going hard. And on one hand, you could say, well, it's his money, it's his business, he can do whatever he wants. And obviously that's true, it's his life. But if it starts threatening to reshape the whole world order, professional golf, because he's going to the Saudis because he really wants that money, you have to question, is it really more than just an individual issue, or is it potentially affecting an entire sport? And you know, I think we're, you know, that's been the missing piece in all this with Phil and the Saudis is why. Why is he doing this? And I think when you understand the scale of the gambling, it gives you a little more insight.
One of the most familiar characters in the whole Phil Mickelson story, Alan, was Jim Bones Mackay, his caddy up until 5 years ago for his entire career to that point. Do you have any insight on why that relationship ended so abruptly?
Yeah, you know, they were always very different characters. And that was part of the fun and the friction of, you know, watching them work. You know, Bones is very methodical and serious and analytical. And we know that Phil is this freewheeling, fun-loving character out there between the ropes. And so you could always feel there was that little edginess. But I think it brought out the best in both of them. But I think over time they might have worn each other out a little bit. But there were some other issues. You know, Phil always kept the 18th hole flags for the victories. And for a long time, he gave them to his grandfather, who tacked them up on the wall, and was a really cute story. But that always bothered Bones in a way that nobody could really understand. He never got the flags, especially after the grandfather passed. But Phil kept the flags, even from their major championship victories. And, you know, during the Phoenix Open, Bones and his wife would host players and caddies for meals or whatever, and everyone would say, where are the flags? You know, you guys have won 40-something tournaments. Where are the flags? And so that was always a huge source of contention in a way that I don't think the rest of us could really fully understand. And then, you know, money was a factor too. And this is a theme that runs through Phil's life, is the money. And so Phil and Bones had already been working together when the FedEx Cup was created. And they kind of had an agreement on how Phil would share some of the, you know, the payouts, which initially were deferred. And then it's always been something that the players and the caddies have had to work out. And so they had a verbal agreement, but Phil just never paid. And over time, that turned into a very large number. You know, by Bones accounting, it was $900,000, which is serious money that he was owed. And so those were two factors. And then just sort of the disregard for his advice. And sometimes Phil would tell him to be at the course at 10 and won't show up till noon. And I think it was just, you know, after 25 years, it was time for them to part ways.
Clearly many facets to this big personality that is Phil Mickelson. In fact, you write at one point that Phil's persona is well-honed stagecraft. What did you mean by that?
Well, people in the game have always known there's a public Phil and there's a private Phil, and there's a divide. And that's probably true for a lot of public figures, and even for the rest of us. You know, we in our daily lives, we wear a certain costume, and in our private lives, we might be different. Because Phil is such a big personality, it was just exaggerated. And so, you know, it's not to say it wasn't sincere. I mean, he loves the fans, and he thrives on their energy and the autographs and the thumbs up, and all those things come from the heart. But, you know, in private, he can be very spicy. He's got an extremely sharp needle. And he can be very profane, and there's a racy side to Phil that, you know, is a little different from the squeaky clean, wholesome image that he presents to the world. So it's not even necessarily a critique. It's just it's a reality for a lot of public figures. But with Phil, the people who really knew him would kind of roll their eyes sometimes at some of his public pronouncements and some of the things he would do, because it was so different from how he was behind closed doors.
Yeah, there's that side of him. Then you describe this scene of Augusta National locker room attendants hugging him after he won the 04 Masters, or Phil working the room at a Bearing Point event, making the guests feel like they're 10 feet tall. What do those anecdotes represent?
Yeah, I mean, that's why Phil is such a fascinating subject for biography, because he is so complex. You know, so many books have written about Tiger, but I find Phil to be far more interesting, because he's just so... there's the extremes, there's these multitudes that live within him, and he can be incredibly generous. I mean, he's done large-scale philanthropy, which he really doesn't talk about, doesn't get the kind of public recognition it probably should, and I think he's happy that way. And many random acts of kindness to fans, to people in the game. You know, there's just, you know, Ryan Palmer tells a story when he found out his wife had breast cancer. He mentioned it to Phil, and Phil wrapped him in this bear hug and said, okay, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to get the best doctors, the best surgeons. They're going to call you tonight. Your family's going to be fine. Everything's going to be... And Ryan said, it all came true. I was on the phone that night with, like, the head of MD Anderson Cancer Center. And, you know, Phil can be incredibly giving. And you mentioned that the locker room attendant. It's a great story. After Phil wins the Masters in 04, you know, finally breaks through. And that night, after the dinners and all the celebrating, he's finally packing up and leaving Augusta National. And it's the guys from the locker room are clinging to Phil, almost like survivors on a life raft. They're holding on to him so dearly, because all these years he's been dispensing these monumental tips, and now he's moving up to the champions locker room, and they're losing him forever, and they're really sad about it. And so, you know, there was a longtime waiter at the Augusta National Clubhouse who was up for a promotion, and Phil wrote him a letter of recommendation. You know, he doesn't have to do that. He doesn't have to take care of, you know, all these disadvantaged kids in San Diego that he buys school supplies for, and all the little things he does. So, I mean, Phil has a big heart. He's a very giving guy, and that's part of who he is. And then there's these other sides to him, too. And that it was fun to peel back those many different layers in this book.
In the statement Phil put out, Alan, when he announced he was stepping away from the game for a period of time almost 3 months ago, now, he said he was going to take time to work on being a better man. What did you take that statement to mean?
Yeah, that was the most interesting part of that word salad. And I think... you know, I think that's bigger than the Saudis. You know, when I started working on this book almost 2 years ago, someone who knows Phil very well said, you know, he's been skating on thin ice for a really long time, and all it's going to take is someone to tap that ice, and it's just going to crack beneath them. I didn't really, you know, think it was going to be me, but, you know, I think, you know, Phil's been playing fast and loose in a lot of ways for a long time. And, you know, think about the stress in your life if you're losing a lot of money gambling, and all the other things that go with that. And, you know, that's just one part of it. And so I think it's really, this was a moment for Phil to reset. And whatever that means in his personal life, in his professional life, in his business life, I think he's taking stock. And, you know, he did this in the winter of 2003. You know, he had his worst season as a pro. And he almost lost both Amy and Evan, his son, in the operating room. And Phil really took some time away and thought about where he was in life and where he wanted to go, and rededicated himself to the game. He got in better physical shape, and he founded his own personal philanthropy vehicle. And 2004 was the best year of his career. And so, you know, and also we saw that with Dustin Johnson. He took his own leave of absence, and he came back a better person and a better player. And so I think that's what we all wish for Phil, is that he really uses his time. And, you know, I actually feel like he can come back more popular than ever. You know, sports fans love a comeback. They love a redemption story. And a slightly more humble, more human Phil Mickelson, I think, will be wildly popular.
Oh, I'm curious if it'll be wildly popular with fans, but are you struck by how little public support there's been from the locker room for Phil during this whole episode?
Yeah, that's interesting, Neil. The silence of the players has spoke volumes, and even some of the sharp criticism, because for all the things that Tiger Woods has done, put his fans through, and his family, you never heard the players take a shot at Tiger. And, of course, some have come out very strongly against Phil. And I was talking to a longtime PGA Tour player who knows both those guys really well. And he said, the difference is Tiger never made himself bigger than the game. And he was putting money in my pocket. Like, he could have left the tour and started his own tour, but he was always loyal to the PGA Tour. And this guy said, Phil's the opposite. He's trying to take money out of my pocket. You know, he could wreck the PGA Tour with the Saudi stuff. And so I think that's why the players have been so sharp in their criticism, because Phil was potentially threatening their livelihood. Now Mickelson would argue that he was trying to make things better for them, and he was an agent of change, and there's some truth to that. But not all the players saw it that way. I mean, they kind of saw that he was working both sides of the street, and it might not be for their own benefit. So the extremely sharp criticism by a lot of top players, I thought, was quite interesting.
Alan, I want to leave you with this. This is an unauthorized biography, but he did talk to you, and those quotes ended up in the book, inflammatory, in the biggest hot water because of this Live Golf endeavor. Are you surprised at the end of the day that he ended up talking to you?
Yes and no. I mean, I went to Phil three times face-to-face and asked him, you know, if he'd sit for interviews for this book. And as I explained to him, it really behooves you to tell your side of every story and put your spin on things. And he thought about it, and he ultimately said no, which is his prerogative. And then right as I was finishing the book, he called me, and he wanted to talk about the tour and Saudi Arabia and all of those things. And I just think Phil, and there's other funny stories in this book about dinner parties where Phil dominates the conversation and no one else can get a word in. Like, we all know, and it's a cliche that's attached to him, but it's true. He wants to be the smartest guy in the room, and he wants to tell you how smart he is. And I think in Phil's mind, he had gamed the system. He was negotiating with the PGA Tour, with the Saudis. Either it was a win-win. Either he's going to get what he wanted from Jay Monahan, or he's going to get this massive payday from the Saudis. And I think he wanted me to know just how clever he was and what a cagey businessman he is. And, you know, he certainly wildly underestimated the emotion around Saudi Arabia as an issue. But I just think Phil has this compulsion. He's an over-explainer, and he wants to get in your head, and he wants to influence you as a reporter. And I'm sure you guys have dealt with that through the years as well. So in the end, even though he'd said he wasn't going to talk to him, he just couldn't help himself. And that's part of who Phil is. He's got these compulsions, and he's always battling his own inherent tendencies. And so he had to pick up the phone and call me. And I was surprised, but it certainly informed the book in an important way.
Alan, by the biographer's standards, events have moved at a really rapid pace over the last few months. Are you in any way afraid that the book might become in some way dated by what's happened in the last couple of months and what will happen in the next few months with Phil?
Not really, because, you know, we took this book down to the wire, and I was able to get all this Saudi stuff and the leave of absence and all that in the book, which is not easy to do 3 months ahead of publication with a big publishing house. And there's supply chain issues in the book industry. They don't have glue and paper. You know, it's hard to move things around, but we did it. And so I think it's pretty much up to the current moment. And whether Phil comes back at Southern Hills or the first Saudi event or the U.S. Open or St. Andrews, I think it's going to be a monumental event. And, you know, the book is going to be an important resource for people who want to understand Phil and during this really turbulent moment in his life. So, you know, I think it's as current as an actual physical paper book can actually be.
Well, Alan, the book is monumental as well. Rip-roaring, a lot of fun, colorful, as in the title. Congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for your time.
All right, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
All right, he is Alan Shipnuck. Coming up next, Teddy G joins us. Best bets from the AT&T. Byron Nelson coming up.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet. This season, don't just bet, live your bet life. And the new Ping PLD putters, designed by pros, played by champions, custom built for you. And by Skechers Go Golf, comfort-driven styles worn by Billy Andre.
Back on Golf Today, the road to Brookline is underway. Local qualifying conducted over 18 holes, taking place at 109 sites in the United States and Canada. Began April 25th through May 23rd, and players who advance out of local will join a group of locally exempt players in final qualifying, which will be conducted over 36 holes at 11 sites between May 23rd and June 6th. Now, Longhorn senior Parker Coody made not one, but two holes in one in the same round Monday to advance through his U.S. Open local qualifier at Forest Creek Golf Club in Round Rock, Texas. Coody told GolfChannel.com afterward, "That was nuts. A couple of rules officials were giving me a hard time about it, like, you got to buy your group a pair of shoes or something." Take a look at that scorecard. There it was, the 17th hole, the 8th hole. Shot 69, but a couple of aces in the same round. Congrats to Parker getting through. Here's some of the candidates for the 2022 Haskins Award presented by Stiefel, the award given annually to the Player of the Year in men's college golf. Gotta love this terrific list. Parker's twin, Pearson Coody, is on this list. David Puge from ASU. A lot of Pac-12, RJ Mankey from UW, Cameron Sisk from ASU as well. Now, the Annika Award presented by Stiefel at the watch list, the best players in the women's game. Rachel Heck from Stanford, Rose Zhang from Stanford, Emma Spitz from my alma mater, UCLA. All right, Maddie, TPC Craig Ranch hosts the AT&T Byron Nelson for the second year in a row. This is the third time the tournament will be held just prior to the PGA Championship, also preceded the major in 2019, 2021 as well. And the event began in 1944 as the Texas Victory Open, won by Byron Nelson. From 1968 on, the Hall of Famer's name was on the event, and this is one of two tournaments named after a professional golfer. Byron Nelson, five-time major champ, first player to win 50 PGA Tour events, 1974 World Golf Hall of Fame inductee, won 11 straight events, 18 total in 1945. So with more on Nelson, we welcome in Sports Illustrated contributor Peter Kaufman. Peter, thanks for the time. Give us a brief history of this tour stop and why it remains so important to the PGA Tour.
Sure. Great to see you, gentlemen. This tournament did start, quote-unquote, start in 1944. It was the Texas Victory Texas Victory Open. It had several names up until the 1950s when it took a 10-year hiatus. My favorite previous name was the oxymoronic Dallas Open Invitational. Go figure that out. And it's really important because Byron Nelson is just one of the most revered players in the history of the PGA. Now, he was born the same year as Hogan and Snead. Nelson won three majors in the 30s, and then he retired after 1945. Hogan and Snead won all of their majors, 7 for Snead, 9 for Hogan, after 1945. And those three gentlemen won each of the three first tournaments. So while the tournament does say that its provenance goes back to 1944, it had a bunch of different names, took 10 years off between, I want to say, 56 and 66, and then it reemerged consistently with Byron Nelson's name in it, along with various sponsors, continually since 68. And, of course, Arnold Palmer is the only other player whose name is on a tournament.
Nelson famously retired, he wanted to make enough money just so he could have a ranch. He could have played much longer. What is his place in golf history, in your opinion?
Well, as I said, he's so revered. He had a tremendous record. He won three majors in the 30s. He won two majors during World War II, and he had two monster years in 44 and 45. Matter of fact, He won half of his PGA at that time record, 52 tournaments, half of those in 44 and 45. And he retired at the top of his game. So he, and you know, he's revered, he's respected, he's the Iron Byron Swing. He was revered in a way that Hogan, for example, wasn't. And Hogan is back in the news because of Tiger's injury. Tiger's such a, and his comeback. Tiger is such a student of history. He's cautioned everyone, wait a second, you want a comeback story? It's Ben Hogan. And that's really true because it's great that Tiger came back and that he made the cut at the Masters. He's going to have to go a long way in his comeback to come close to what Hogan did. Hogan had only won three majors at the time of his accident when he was 37 years old, and he had grievous injuries in that car accident. The problem was not the injuries per se, it was the secondary effects because he had blood clots going into his lungs. They had to tie off his lesser vena cava, his inferior vena cava, which cut off circulation to his legs for the rest of his career. And he, while he won 37 tournaments between 45 and 49, 37 tournaments, he only played in a handful after that, and he won six of his nine majors after that. He lost two in a playoff because he just couldn't walk an extra 18 holes. So Hogan was the steely, cold, tough guy who with the perfect swing. Hogan, Nelson, his compatriot going back to childhood, was the beloved sort of grandfatherly figure who stuck around until the mid-2000s, and everybody revered him.
Peter, the PGA Championship is a little over a week away. What to you is the single most compelling storyline?
I'm going to give you a little bit broader answer, Eamon. I think Tiger playing another major. I think Phil, the defending champion, with all the circus swirling around him. I think some lesser interesting stories. Jordan Spieth trying for the career slam. Rory McIlroy back on form. And those two gents have a lot of major drought to make up for. Rory's 0 for his last 28. Spieth's 0 for his last 17. And my under-the-radar storyline is it's a home event for Victor Hovland. I like him quietly coming at this.
Peter, great to spend a few minutes with you looking back on one of the great careers in golf history. Enjoy this week and next week as well. We'll speak to you soon.
Great. Nice to see you.